From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
You're familiar with that clip, "We came, we saw, he died." Is that the Clinton doctrine?
That was Representative Peter Roskam, an Illinois Republican member of the House of Representatives, questioning former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on her role in setting U.S. policy in Libya, which resulted in the destruction of that country and the death of thousands of Libyans, including former leader Muammar Gaddafi. Roskam was referring to a now-famous quote of Clinton's, captured on camera while the then-Secretary of State was waiting to be interviewed, upon being texted that Gaddafi had been killed by U.S.-backed rebels.
"Yes, we came, we saw, he died."
Clinton's response Thursday to Roskam's interrogatory included an apparent admission that despite previous denials by herself and the White House, the U.S. policy towards Libya was in fact a policy of regime change.
"That was an expression of relief that the military mission undertaken by NATO and our other partners had achieved its end, and therefore no more American, European, or Arab lives would be at stake in trying to prevent Gaddafi from wreaking havoc on Libyans or causing more problems to the region and beyond."
The U.S. military conducted a massive bombing campaign of Libya beginning in March of 2011 that continued until November of that year. The aerial campaign supported the ground forces that ultimately overrode the country, which then had a population of only 6 million people. However, absent direct authorization from the UN Security Council, a military campaign to unseat a sitting government would be a per se criminal violation of international law. Thus, Clinton's admission in Thursday's session, under oath, appeared to be an admission to international war crimes. Former six-term representative and Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney was on the ground in Libya for part of the time that the country was being pounded by U.S. bombing. We spoke with her via Skype Friday. Did you tell us what it was like, first of all, for the people in Libya who were supposedly being the beneficiaries of a humanitarian rescue to go through 7.5 months of bombing?
Well, first of all, it was terrorism. If there's any definition of terrorism that has been used and given by the government of the United States, what the U.S. did to the people of Libya was sheer, pure terrorism. It was the use of violence to achieve a political goal. And that violence was directed against the civilian Libyan population, fishermen in the sea, blown out of the water, people who are selling their trade, their goods on the street, blown up, the hospitals, the schools, blown up. And so there wasn't a civilian place that was off limits. And we now know that to be the modus operandi of the United States, because they just did it to Médecins Sans Frontières doctors in Afghanistan. They bombed the hospital while the doctors were in there conducting surgery. So this is not anything new. This is not a surprise, but it is yet another confirmation of the way the United States behaves of late.
It appears that although there were denials repeatedly out of the White House and out of then Secretary of State Clinton, that the U.S. objective in Libya was anything but protection of the Libyan people from their government and not regime change and not the killing of Muammar Gaddafi, that yesterday under oath she said essentially that, that the objective was satisfied in response to a question about her, "We came, they saw, he died."
Well, the objective was satisfied, and so now you've got Libya in chaos.
A call for an end to support for terrorism in Syria. After taking a direct military role to drive terrorists out of Syria, Moscow was calling for an end to financial and military aid to anti-government fighters in that country. Press TV's Riley Wagaman reports from Moscow.
Russia has been conducting a military campaign as part of an agreement with Iran, Iraq, and Syria to help clear the Middle East of Daesh Takfiri terrorists. The Russian military action has proved effective, but the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs remains concerned about foreign support for the terrorists. The ministry says ending foreign support and financing for terrorists operating in Syria is now a top priority for Russia.
We have information that terrorist groups continue to receive shipments of equipment and reinforcement from abroad. This is a very dangerous trend. It is clear that without such a support, victory of the terrorists could be achieved much faster.
The Russian Foreign Ministry also reiterated the Kremlin's concerns over reports that at least 4,000 militants from ex-Soviet republics have joined the ranks of Daesh and other terrorist groups operating in Syria and Iraq. The remarks come 2 days after Syrian President Bashar al-Assad made an unannounced visit to Moscow to meet with Putin. The brief Moscow trip, which was made public Wednesday morning, marks the first time that the Syrian president has traveled abroad since the outbreak of the deadly militancy in the country in March 2011. Assad's visit to Moscow has been interpreted by some as a sign of Russia's growing influence in the Middle East. But for Russia, its involvement in Syria is less about exerting influence and more about preventing terrorism from reaching its doorstep. Riley Wagaman, Press TV, Moscow.
The whistleblower organization WikiLeaks published a second set of documents obtained from CIA Director John Brennan's personal email account. The first set of documents published Wednesday contained reports on Afghanistan and torture, along with suggestions for U.S. policy towards Iran. The latest release from WikiLeaks reportedly includes Brennan's address book. A number of elections this week in the Latin America region and also in Africa. We discussed that with a reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
This weekend is one of the busiest weekends for many, for as long as I can remember, in terms of elections, not just in Latin America, but elsewhere as well. And perhaps we should start with a couple of the elections. There's big elections in presidential runoff in Guatemala, presidential elections, and I think also legislative elections in Argentina. Haiti's having its presidential election and also a rerun of its disastrous legislative elections that happened, I think, about a month ago, maybe over a month ago, that were a complete washout for various reasons. But also in Colombia, there's a very important election for the municipal authority in Bogota, the capital of Colombia. And also the other side of the Atlantic, and I use West Africa, North and West Africa as a reference for, you know, what's going on in terms of the imperialist toolbox and what they're, you know, the latest tricks that they're up to. And right now, over this weekend, there's going to be an election, as you probably know, Don, in Ivory Coast.
Yes.
That's, you know, they're a very depressing situation. And when we talk about Haiti, perhaps we should keep Ivory Coast in mind, because Ivory Coast has very much been Haitianized, if you like, by the United States and France and its allies, and backed up disgracefully by the UN, as they're playing a similar role as they have in Haiti.
Yep.
So that's a brief summary of the panorama, but there are a couple of other things that we should try and talk about, or at least mention, and that is the political situation in Brazil, where Dilma Rousseff continues to be under assault from right-wing legislators, the leader of whom, and I'm not sure if he's in the Senate, it's a guy called Cunha, he himself, an opposition politician who's trying to promote this soft coup using abusing parliamentary procedures to attack the country's legitimate president, just as the right-wing opposition did in Paraguay some years ago.
Right.
Cunha himself is subject to investigation for alleged fraud involving Petrobras, the Brazilian state oil company. But there, one very positive development has been that a congressional investigation committee actually found that while there was systematic corruption in Petrobras, neither Dilma Rousseff herself nor her predecessor, Ignacio Lula da Silva, were in any way involved in that systematic corruption in the state oil company, we should bear in mind that although Petrobras is in fact the state oil company, it's got very significant foreign shareholdings. I can't remember the percentage at the moment. So in the same way that the state oil company in Mexico has been a battleground between the private sector and people trying to defend the public sector, so is Petrobras in Brazil.
Right.
And it's very important that the Brazilian Congressional Investigation Committee has found that neither Ignacio Lula da Silva nor Dilma Rousseff were in any way involved in the corrupt goings-on in Petrobras over the previous decade.
Yeah, you know what? So that, on that point, when I first saw the right wing going after Lula on that count, I started to feel comfortable about how Rousseff would come out of that, because they were clearly overreaching and making it clearly political at that point.
Oh, yeah, and I think the general feeling in the country is that the broad political opinion supports the government and is somewhat resentful of right-wing attempts to kind of game a result that they were unable to achieve by legitimate electoral means. So that's what's going on in Brazil, and let's see how things develop there. Over in Bolivia, Evo Morales has been authorized to stand for re-election as president there, and he's almost certainly going to win by yet another landslide.
Yeah.
And that's a huge positive for Bolivia and for the region,
for the world.
So, you know, I think that has a lot to do not just with his domestic policies in terms of democratizing the Bolivian economy and bringing millions of people into economic activity that were unable to participate before, lifting people out of poverty and so on. It's also got to do with his very firm stand in defense of Bolivia's sovereign right to access to the Pacific Ocean. And other people might not see the same as me, but I see a very marked difference between the confidence and the self-confidence and the righteousness of Evo Morales and Bolivia's stand, and the arrogant, somewhat incompetent stand being taken by the Chilean authorities. So that's another theme that we can follow up perhaps in another program. So, and where should we start? Should we start with the election in Bogota?
Yeah, because that's going to be an interesting one to watch, given the whole context of things inside of Colombia.
Well, it looks as though the left-wing candidate Clara Lopez, I've forgotten the name. I think it's Petri, the name of the current mayor, who was he himself suffered a kind of mini attempted coup, and I think we talked about this. Was it last year? But his term's up, and he's a progressive figure, and it looks as though the electors in Bogota are going to elect a very popular progressive figure called Clara Lopez. And Clara Lopez is a very interesting person, and I didn't know much about her until I was boning up for our discussion this morning. But it turns out that she's actually from a very wealthy family, and her uncle was a Liberal Party president from the same party as Juan Manuel Santos, the current president. And he served as president of Colombia from in the late 70s, but Clara Lopez ended up, and she was very privileged background, but she ended up joining the Frente Patriotico, the Unión Patriotica, which was a left wing parliamentary party that many people in Colombia, especially the right wing, of course, just called the FARC, and the civilian arm of the FARC, of the Colombian guerrilla, and so she took a huge chance, in her own personal terms, because between from the mid 80s to the early 90s, between 3,000 and 5,000 members of the Unión Patriótica were assassinated, mostly by right wing paramilitaries, organized by individuals like Álvaro Uribe, the extreme right-wing narco-terror president who kept Colombia under his thumb from the late 90s I think he served two presidential terms, ending in 2008, I think. Anyway, so Clara Lopez took that path, which was very brave of her. And subsequently, she's obviously a very strong woman, and she was one of the of two women that ran for the presidency on Colombia's first all-woman presidential ticket. I've forgotten when that was, back in 2004 or something. But then subsequently, she was quite controversial because she came out and endorsed the presidential candidacy of Juan Manuel Santos at a time when Juan Manuel Santos was far from being the figure clearly committed to peace that he is now. And that was very far-sighted of her and very brave of her, because politically, her supporters were quite taken aback by that. But it was very brave of her, and it turns out to have been a very astute political decision, and she's likely to capitalize on that, the prestige that she got from making that decision and from backing the peace process, now in this election on Sunday for the municipal authority in Bogota, because the peace process has advanced so far that anybody who promoted it, Juan Manuel Santos or Clara Lopez or whoever, has very positive associations in voters' minds. So she's likely to do very well on Sunday.
So she, might have actually been one of the brokers of bringing the president to, to the peace table.
Yeah, and I think that her courageous political decision to go against her natural instincts and to support Santos and to urge people to vote for Santos, in some ways it wasn't a difficult decision to make because the alternative was Álvaro Uribe. You know, and it's kind of like, do you want to vote for Satan or, somebody who might not be Satan?
Right. Sounds like America. Except that America, they always turn out to be Satan anyway.
Right. Yeah, and Juan Manuel Santos has turned out to be, by his conservative lights, he's turned out to be a moderate figure who's been himself courageous enough to gauge the sense of the times and to see the way that people are feeling in Colombia after what now 60 years of civil war.
Yeah, right.
And so he's, it's not surprising that he and people like him and people like Clara Lopez have gravitated towards a consensus around peace.
Yeah, I mean, it seems more surprising to me that the part of the elite that still backs a continuation of the policies that resulted in 60 years of civil war still have some political juice at all.
Well, yeah, and that just goes to show how corrupt Colombian politics and society and the economy have become or became as a result of the policies of people like Álvaro Uribe and their right-wing supporters and the hawks in the Colombian military, and it has to be said the completely counterproductive and pernicious policies of the United States State Department.
That's right. So
that's what's going on in Colombia. Time's ticking on, Don. Should we talk about Haiti?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so and Haiti is not I'm not an expert by any means on Haiti, but I'm just looking at what the United States and France and Canada and the United Nations have achieved and their allies have achieved in Haiti is kind of totally depressing. They've completely destroyed the country.
Yeah.
The elections that are taking place on Sunday are to elect a president to replace I think it's Michel Martelly, the current president.
Martelly, yeah.
And there are actually, it's so chaotic. There are a total of something like over 50 candidates that are kind of taking place in the election. It has to be remembered that Martelly himself was elected in a ridiculously flawed and yet a grotesque kind of caricature of what an electoral process should be, and I think he won with something like 7 or 8% of the vote on a turnout of something under 40%. I can't remember the exact figures.
Yeah, it's even worse now. We have, along with the presidential election, the second round in legislative elections. That's after they reconfigured the legislature, and after a turnout, it was minuscule, 20-30%. I forget what it was, extremely low. And the outcome.
Yeah, it was 18%.
Yeah.
The turnout was 18%, and they managed to elect just 10 legislators.
Yeah, out of, I forget.
Out of 139.
Yeah.
You know, and it was so. And that, you know, that was a rerun of the electorate, the kind of phony, ridiculous, absurd electoral process that took place, and of which Michel Martelly was the beneficiary.
And with ten, that means some of those were engineered, because coming out of it, there were only three, I think, that had won for certain, and then the rest had to be adjudicated somehow under the conditions that exist there now.
Yeah, and specialists in Haiti will be able to tell you who the candidates are. You know, and there's supposed to be some, what's his name?
From Lavalas?
No, it's not from Lavalas. It's something called, I think the candidate's called La Paix.
Uh-huh.
And his party is the, Ligue Alternative para el Progrès, the Alternative League for the Progress and Emancipation of Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he's the front runner, apparently, among all these people that are running for the presidency. And it's just so stupid. It's kind of, how can you have a meaningful election in the conditions to which Haiti's been subject for the last 10 years? And it's just so, it's meaningless, and it just satisfies appearances.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, really, since they dragged Aristide out of there and shipped him off to Central African Republic?
Yeah, Central African Republic, yeah.
The entire political process there has been completely managed by the United States.
Yeah, and it looks like Jean-Bertrand Aristide is back in Haiti, and he returned. When did he return? Don, about 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Yeah, again, yeah. I remember that he came back with Amy Goodman on the plane, and then he left again. I forgot where he went the second time.
Yeah. So anyway, he's back in Haiti, but it looks as though, and he's been told by the powers the behind the scenes, the United States government, the French government, the Canadian government under Stephen Harper, and let's see how Canada's policy towards Haiti changes over the next while under some, what is it, Justin Trudeau, the new president-elect, and the Canada's policy to Haiti may change, we'll see. But time behind those foreign governments, the North American governments and their French allies in particular, will have told Aristide to take a back seat and don't even think about regenerating Family Lavalas. And so he has taken a very low profile and isn't involved directly, so far as I can see, in political activity in Haiti, and certainly not in this presidential and legislative electoral campaign. So, you know, and it's that's all very depressing, and one can only hope that at some point, and it just what's happening in Haiti and what's happened in Ivory Coast is a perfect example of how the United States destroys countries, how the United States and its European allies, in particular France, destroys countries and then takes advantage of the chaos to exploit their natural resources, which is all they're interested in. They couldn't care less about the people in these countries, although their interventions are carried out under the banner of humanitarian interventions are based on a responsibility to protect. How deeply cynical and hypocritical that is.
Aristide,
moving on from Haiti, there's Argentina. Do we have time to talk about Argentina?
Yeah, before we do that, though, Aristide apparently spoke out in public for the first time since he came back in 2011. That's when he came back this time. He was calling for people to vote for Maurice Narcisse, who's the Lavalas candidate.
Right.
And there were a few thousand people apparently waiting for him for hours to speak, and it's the first time he's made, been out in public in, the almost 5 years that he's been back in the country. And last year, apparently, they threw him under house arrest again.
Right, yeah. No, and it's and he's subject to enormous pressure, intimidation, very, very cynical. And the elections, if the last elections of a few weeks ago are anything to go by, there'll be absolute chaos on Sunday, violence, blatant electoral fraud, vote rigging, ballot stuffing, you name it.
Yeah, right.
And so, and the chances of Maurice Narcisse, the Famille Lavalas candidate, doing well, probably pretty minimal. But let's see, you never know.
Then you have to serve your term without getting carried off to the Central African Republic.
Well, yeah, and that's, and just that precedent itself is enough to intimidate people from attempting to carry out anything like a sovereign political program in favor of the Haitian people.
Mm. And then you had you mentioned Cote d'Ivoire. You had the elected president there, Gbagbo, carted off at gunpoint by the French up to the Hague, to the ICC, where he stands trial. At least they didn't take Aristide there yet.
Yeah, and I hope that we'll be able to talk about that. And let's see. And next week, maybe we'll have more time to talk about what's going on in Ivory Coast.
Yeah, definitely.
And should we try and talk a little bit about Argentina?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, okay, so the situation in Argentina is that there are six presidential candidates altogether. And the very, very clear favorite is Daniel Scioli of the Frente por la Victoria, I think they're called, which is the party of the Kirchner's, Nestor Kirchner, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, Nestor Kirchner's wife. And of course, Nestor Kirchner was the kind of center-left politician that is viewed as the person who turned Argentina around after the economic and financial debacle of the early years of 2000, 2001, 2002. And there was a period, I think, in which Argentina had four or five presidents in the period of just a week. Back then, and Nestor Kirchner turned the country around, rescued it, put it on a sovereign political footing, thumbed his nose at the IMF, told them to get lost, and Cristina Fernandez followed those policies. And of course, the one of the big achievements of Nestor Kirchner's government and subsequently Cristina's government has been their defense of Argentina's monetary financial sovereignty against the vulture funds. And there was a very positive, there have been two very positive judgments this week. But I'm sticking with the presidential campaign. Daniel Scioli it seems to be streets ahead of the nearest opposing candidate, who is a guy called Mauricio Macri, who's been a very successful politician in terms of he's the kind of mayor of Buenos Aires. And Daniel Scioli has a long track record. Daniel Scioli is another interesting character from a very privileged background. Nothing like as radical as Clara Lopez in Colombia, but and a very interesting character. That's a part. The policies that people will be voting on are the very successful policies that have sustained Argentina's economic activity, although they're going through a difficult time now as a result of dropping prices. There's a lot of things that you could criticize about the policies instigated by Nestor and Kirchner and Cristina Fernandez, and that will certainly be carried on by Daniel Scioli. But they have been very successful in terms of sustaining and improving the living standards and protecting the living standards of the majority of people in Argentina. So it's extremely unlikely that Daniel Scioli will lose.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.